Why 5G Matters to You, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The president is banning foreign adversaries from supplying equipment for the nation's 5G infrastructure. We're talking next-generation broadband service. How does that affect you?
For a typical person, the result is going to be higher prices on their wireless services.
Some industry insiders disagree, and this one thinks President Trump's move is the right one.
The reason that it was declared as, a national emergency is because it is a security threat, and that's the first and primary reason for it, because it is.
Plus, this is a bad week for breathing the air in Mexico City, a really bad week.
And I immediately can feel the effects now. It hurts, like your throat starts to hurt. I feel it.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you along this Thursday. If you like fast wireless broadband, you're going to love 5G. That's what they tell us.
5G is the next generation of wireless technologies, faster speeds, and in general, a better broadband experience.
If your phone is already connecting to 4G or LTE, what's 5G going to get you?
Much faster speeds, much more capacity.
Two people there who are deep in the 5G industry. They agree on the speed of 5G, but that's about all they agree on. More from them in a moment. President Trump's executive order yesterday bans U.S. companies building 5G networks with equipment from, quote, foreign adversaries. Trump's order doesn't name names, but the target is clear. Chinese telecom giant Huawei, a global leader in the technology that goes into 5G networks. One of the voices we just heard was Declan Ganley, the CEO of Rivada Networks based in the U.S. He likes the idea of banning Huawei.
I think it's a necessary move. It's timely and sends the right message around the world. It recognizes the threat that the Communist Party of China, through entities in the 5G technology sector coming out of China, the threat that they pose to cybersecurity and the cyber domain, and this is one of the five key strategic domains of potential conflict. Well, you've got land, sea, air, space, and cyber, and 5G is the key to cyber, and this somewhat starts to thwart Beijing's efforts to dominate the cyber domain globally.
Do you support the executive order just because it's a security threat? I mean, how do you see kind of its threat to U.S. technological supremacy, or is that not a concern?
Well, I mean, the reason that it was declared as, a national emergency is because it is a security threat, and that's the first and primary reason for it, because it is. But to your point, it also disrupts or starts to flip the table on a model that Beijing has used to advance this cause, to try and dominate cyber and 5G globally.
So what does this disruption, shutting out Huawei, what does it mean for companies like yours? I mean, does it give you suddenly an advantage that you didn't have before?
I would say what it does is it takes away an unfair advantage that some of the incumbents were using against companies, innovative companies like my own.
So it sounds like what you're saying is with this executive order, you've now got the headspace to innovate. But Huawei claims the U.S. won't be able to roll out 5G networks without its technology. Is that true?
Not only is it not true, I would say that if they had been allowed in, what would have happened is that they would have allowed the status quo to continue. And it's the same thing in Europe and elsewhere around the world. Huawei and ZTE, backed by the Chinese Communist Party and the government, they were able to get subsidies.
Right, and ZTE is the other big manufacturer of smartphones, correct?
And not just smartphones, but 5G networking equipment, yeah? Once you remove the influence of Chinese money and subsidies from the 5G industry, and hopefully we're going to see this happen in other countries as well, once you remove that, frankly, corrupting influence, corrupting in terms of the business models that it allows to be sustained. When you take that out, it forces innovation. And that innovation is going to result in lower prices, much broader coverage, and much more innovation. This is a very positive move.
Can you just lay out for us what is so great about 5G? Like, what does it do that LTE and 4G can't currently do?
Speed, capacity, and price. So you're going to get much faster speeds, much more capacity, and if we have our way, if Rivada has anything to do with it, much lower prices for those services. Also, ubiquity. that because you can change the business model, and this is really economics even more than the technology, but you're going to have coverage into rural areas that are currently not covered.
That's Declan Ganley, CEO of Rivada Networks. Scott Walston disagrees with a lot of Ganley's assessment of 5G. Walston is president and senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute in Washington.
I don't want to dismiss the security concerns, but it's rarely the case that when you block competition, you're going to get more innovation. If anything, there's less pressure to innovate. So that'll be a problem.
So you do have these security concerns, and the U.S. has said repeatedly over the years that Huawei is a security threat. Do you think it is? And does this ban mean Americans and our networks will be more secure?
Well, I'm certainly not qualified to say whether it's actually, you know, with the severity of the security threat. Most people who are seem to agree that there is a real security threat, but it's hard to know how severe that is when we're also in the middle of a trade war with China. And some of our allies have done the cost-benefit analysis and reached a different conclusion, thinking that they can manage whatever security threat there is.
So if a friend were to ask you, Scott, what impact will this executive order have on me, what would you tell them? Like, what would be your jargon-free answer?
Right. It's hard for me to speak without jargon. But for a typical person, the result is going to be higher prices on their wireless services. One of the major inputs into supplying these services is the equipment. And now the main competition for the equipment is between Huawei, Nokia, and Ericsson. And we are deciding to keep out the low-cost provider. So what we're left with is two providers who probably don't have enough capacity right now to supply the entire market and whose equipment is more expensive generally. It may be higher quality too, but it's more expensive. And so you're raising everybody's cost, all of the suppliers' cost, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, all the rural companies, anybody who needs the equipment that these companies produce. And if you raise everybody's costs, that translates into higher prices for consumers.
If Trump hadn't made this executive order, describe one likely future scenario for the U.S. and 5G.
Well, we have to assume that the executive order is going to make a difference, because even before this executive order, I think most companies had pretty much agreed not to use Huawei equipment. So, you know, one possibility is that the executive order doesn't mean anything because, in fact, the decision has already been made not to use Huawei. Another possibility is that that the executive order does mean something, and companies would have been more free to use Huawei equipment, maybe not now, but maybe in a year. And that would have meant lower costs to build out the 5G network and lower prices for consumers. But we would have had the security risks that come with Huawei, and that's what we would need to balance. So as, you know, typical consumers, or even as an economist who doesn't have access to any top secret information, I don't know how to balance those two sides, the security versus the cost. But I think those are the possible differences in the outcomes.
Scott Walston with the Technology Policy Institute in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The air is so bad in Mexico City today that students got an unexpected day off because officials don't want them breathing it. The Mexican capital often has bad air, but this city of some 21 million people has been blanketed in an especially noxious smog since Saturday. City officials even moved the semifinals of the First Division Soccer League outside the capital. Reporter Emily Green is on the streets of Mexico City. Sorry to do this to you, Emily, but we just wanted kind of a real-time reaction from you about what the air quality is like right now.
It's okay. You're just trying to kill me.
No.
Well, no, it is. The air quality is bad. And I was trying to think about how to explain it. And I think the best explanation is that it feels very heavy. I wish I could give a better description than that, but it doesn't quite feel like you're breathing this fresh mountainous air or even normal city air. It feels incredibly heavy, and it feels heavy on the lungs.
I've been in Mexico City when they had a bad pollution few days, and I felt myself waking up early in the morning with shallow breathing. Is this the kind of pollution that you can actually taste and feel?
You can definitely feel it. I have asthma, for example, and I was thinking I was doing okay, and then right before this interview, I kind of felt short of breath, and I took a puff on my inhaler. You know, that happens all the time, but it's happening more right now. And people here are talking about the air quality. It is a topic of conversation. And including among some of my friends here in Mexico City, here's one of them, Sarah Barrett. She is Canadian and has been living here for the past couple of years. She says her breathing has gotten extraordinarily bad in the past couple of months, and really in the past week, it's taken a toll.
And I immediately can feel the effects now. I should probably go and buy one of those face masks, but I haven't. It hurts, like your throat starts to hurt. You feel it.
So what's the story? Why has the pollution been so bad there in recent days?
It's worth noting that the pollution here is always bad. That is a chronic problem for Mexico City. One of the things that's happened, though, is that we are in rainy season, or we should be in rainy season. It starts in May, and we've gotten very, very little rain. It's been incredibly dry and incredibly hot. And that has sparked wildfires around the country, and there are at least 20 in the outskirts of Mexico City. So those wildfires are adding particles and pollutants to the air. And the combination of the lack of rain to clear out the pollution and these wildfires is what's contributing to the very bad air quality in the past couple of days.
So you're managing your asthma with inhalers. What kind of health risk generally is the pollution causing for people who breathe it in?
I talked to a lung specialist. Her name is Marisol Arroyo, and she said she's seen a 30% increase in patients in the last week alone. She says that basically people who have breathing problems, it's getting worse. And then people who have general health problems, they are also having an exacerbation of their health issues. I tried to sort of understand what's going on. And here's what she had to tell me.
Y ahorita estamos respirando partículas inorgánicas.
What she's saying is we are breathing here in Mexico City heavy inorganic particles. And on top of that, we're breathing material that we don't normally, like lead, carbon dioxide, nitrogen dioxide. So this is pretty dire.
So, Emily, what can people in Mexico City do to protect themselves?
Eek! I wish they could do more. I am seeing some people walk around with face masks. But there's not much. Again, I asked Dr. Arroyo about what patients can do and what normal people can do.
Realmente sí, ahorita es mantener toda la ventilación, digamos, cerrada.
And what she says is that the basic recommendation is to limit the amount of time that you're outside and when you're inside to have the windows closed. And also to avoid exercise. You know, we're always hearing, do exercise, do exercise. She says that's not the thing to do because it increases the frequency of your respiration and the amount of polluting particles that you're breathing in.
So, Emily, as you cast your eyes across the street there in the Mexican capital, are there fewer people? Are there fewer cars? And what is the Mexico City government trying to do to address this problem?
I am standing on the street now, and there are a lot of cars. And there's also a lot of people. You know, despite the pollution, people have lives to live. They have to go to work. And in terms of Mexico City, it's really a challenge because this is not something they're able to solve on a short-term basis. They have put in new limitations in terms of cars with certain license plates can't drive on certain days. So they are trying to limit the number of cars. But the fact of the matter is, in order to address the pollution here in Mexico City, you're going to have to take some long-term measures like improving transportation and putting more restrictions on the emissions that cars can make. And there's not much they can do on a short-term basis.
Reporter Emily Green on the streets of Mexico City. Time to get inside, Emily. Take care and thanks very much.
Thank you. I'm going there now.
Just ahead, looking for glimmers of hope in the war in Yemen. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Venezuela is still a big story, an update to what's going on there. The opposition continues to question the legitimacy of President Nicolas Maduro, and Maduro officials are still accusing the opposition of treason. But there's a twist. The government of Norway is now trying to mediate between the two sides. A Venezuelan diplomat today confirmed that talks have taken place in Oslo. A couple of the issues that divide the two sides, corruption and oil. Specifically, whether Maduro and before him, Hugo Chavez, have used the profits from Venezuela's national oil company to create a global criminal enterprise and prop up Venezuela's collapsing economy. That is the view of Caitlin Yates. She's a co-author of a new study for the National Defense University called Maduro's Last Stand. It argues that Venezuela's government is involved in illicit activities like illegal gold mining and money laundering to keep their economy afloat.
In one case, the Venezuelan currency was being exchanged for the dollar at a rate much higher than normally been the case. That money was then exchanged into dollars, sent to Switzerland and other offshore accounts before then coming back to the United States and being used to purchase fixed assets, including houses and planes and tangible goods like that. And ultimately, what eventually happened was at least $1.2 billion was laundered.
When we spoke with Yates this week, she also told us that recent court cases show the Venezuelan government is linked to dissidents from Colombia who are trafficking cocaine through Venezuelan territory.
There's increasingly a lot more information in the open source about the dissidents themselves operating in Venezuela and continuing to move these planes or these shipments of cocaine through Venezuela as it becomes increasingly easy to do so.
U.S. economic sanctions are squeezing the Venezuelan economy and cutting off markets where it can sell its oil. But according to Caitlin Yates, that pressure will have little impact as long as the illegal activities continue.
Our ultimate conclusion here is that without trying to understand the complexity, both in the number of actors and in the amount of money that's moving, it's going to be really, really hard to imagine that the Maduro regime is going to fall anytime soon.
So even as Washington tightens its sanctions, these criminal activities provide more than enough revenue to fund the security forces and paramilitary groups that are still loyal to the Maduro regime. The war in Yemen has been 5 years of misery for the civilians caught up in it. In the past few days, a whiplash of events. Yesterday, the United Nations Special Envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, updated the UN Security Council with some good news.
Today, of course, I'm very pleased to report to the Council on progress in the implementation of the Hodeidah Agreement.
The Hodeidah Agreement was between two warring sides who would step back from the brink of battle in the port city of Hodeidah that provides Yemen with most of its food and fuel. The two sides are the Yemeni government, backed by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, and the Houthi rebels, favored by Iran. Even in this small bit of progress, the UN's Martin Griffiths tempered his optimism.
But there are also alarming signs of the war, and war has a habit of trumping peace.
Those alarming signs of war include a drone attack by Houthi rebels. They hit an oil pipeline in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis retaliated with an airstrike that killed Yemeni civilians, including children. So a volatile 48 hours on the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. Gerald Feierstein was the U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 2010 to 2013. This is how he sees this week of news from Yemen.
Well, I think the important thing about the drone strike and the Saudi response to that is that it's really disconnected from the conflict inside of Yemen. The strike and Saudi retaliation really are related more to the growing tensions between Iran, the United States, and our Gulf partners than it is about what's happening in Yemen.
I think the Houthis would not agree with that. They say they're fighting the Saudis and they're not part of Iran. This is a Houthi spokesperson speaking with the BBC just last night.
We are not agents of Iran. If we were, we would not be talking to you now. All we want is for the aggression to stop. We are able to take this decision by ourselves. If they stop their aggression and siege, we will stop our missiles and our drones.
So what about that, Ambassador Feierstein? Are the Houthis agents of Iran, or are they homegrown militants?
Well, methinks he doth protest too much. The fact of the matter is, one, I don't think that the Houthis are agents of Iran necessarily. I do agree that the conflict that's going on in Yemen is primarily a civil war, of which the Houthis are one of the parties to that conflict. But I do think that they are responsive to Iranian direction, Iranian requests.
So you were the U.S. ambassador to Yemen just before the war. What road do you see ahead for Yemen right now?
I think that too many people in the West do look at the Yemen conflict primarily as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They see Yemen only through the perspective of their views on Saudi Arabia and Saudi policy and Mohammed bin Salman in particular.
How do we escape that dilemma, though? Because this is all part of how Washington sees Yemen right now. It's part of the whole Middle East kind of connectivity with Iran and with Saudi Arabia.
It's there. I can't say that the Saudi-Iranian confrontation isn't feeding into the internal Yemeni problem. But even if you resolve the Saudi-Iranian issue, you would still have the internal conflict in Yemen. And I think that those of us who've worked on Yemen, those of us who care about what happens in Yemen, need to continue making the effort to explain to members of Congress, to the public, that this is really a Yemeni civil war. In my view, it revolves around issues of political disenfranchisement, economic marginalization, social issues, the tensions between various sections of the country, particularly north and south.
And then, of course, there is a humanitarian cost. I mean, it is enormous, as you know. After 4 years, tens of thousands of civilians have died in the crossfire. Humanitarians are trying to deliver aid in the middle of all this. People like Scott Paul with Oxfam, he sees a military pullback from the ports in Hodeida, though, as a big deal.
The fact that the Houthis have withdrawn from the ports has hopefully laid the groundwork for the kinds of agreements going forward that are going to increase the ability of importers to bring commodities through that port. In the meantime, the violence we saw last night in Sana'a shows what communities all over Yemen have endured.
And continue to endure. Ambassador Feierstein, why has the human cost of this war in Yemen not been the strongest argument for Washington in dealing with the war and being firm with the proxy actors in this war?
Well, of course, we only have a relationship with one of the proxy actors, the Saudis. We don't have an ability to engage the Iranians in a serious way about the Yemen conflict and try to get their help in bringing the Houthis back to the negotiating table and to a resolution of the conflict. And that's part of the problem here in Washington. People can only think about and talk about the Saudi role without looking at what both sides are doing and how they both can be part of the solution as well as part of the problem.
Gerald Feierstein was U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 2010 to 2013. He's been speaking with us from the Middle East Institute in Washington. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wants more merit-based immigration, and some think the country needs that.
You know, our economy has changed. We don't need the muscle and brawn that we needed in industries 100 years ago. We need more brains.
We'll get the details on what the president is proposing and hear what critics say is really needed. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump stepped into the White House Rose Garden today to sketch out his administration's plan to overhaul immigration and put a little pressure on Congress while he was at it.
Our plan achieves two critical goals. First, it stops illegal immigration and fully secures the border. And second, it establishes a new legal immigration system that protects American wages, promotes American values, and attracts the best and brightest from all around the world.
I have with me Monica Campbell, who covers immigration for The World. Monica, what strikes you about what Trump outlined today?
Well, we heard a speech about the type of immigrants the U.S. should want and those it should not. And we'll be hearing more of this heading into 2020. We haven't seen a detailed plan yet. A couple of things have come through so far. First, a proposal for more border wall, better inspections of goods and people at the border. And then second, and this is probably the most significant part of what we heard today, is a drastic reworking of legal migration, so green cards. This plan would significantly cut how many family-based green cards are allowed, limiting those to spouses and children. And it would favor immigrants who speak English, have degrees, have good job offers with good salaries through a point system. So it kind of flips the preference away from families and more to so-called high-skilled immigrants.
Right. It's that merit-based system that seems to have grabbed headlines so far. Trump points to Canada's merit-based immigration system as a model. Is it a good model? Is it a good comparison?
The people I've talked to, you often hear it's a pretty messy comparison because what it leaves out is that Canada lets in more immigrants overall as a percentage of its population than the U.S. Canada also accepts more refugees per capita than the U.S. You're also overlooking a main difference in the United States, that we have a large undocumented population, many people working in low-skilled areas, agriculture, construction, the service sector, and that there are severe shortages in these sectors. Jobs U.S. citizens are not filling. Mm. So this point-based system doesn't address that. Critics of the plan say it overlooks the U.S. economy and how it works, and how people from different walks of life contribute to the U.S. in different ways.
So realistically, does this plan have any chance in Congress?
It's going to be really tough. Maybe this is something some Republicans will rally around, perhaps on the more moderate side. Hardliners are upset that this doesn't reduce migration in a clear way. For the Democrats, they say, where's DACA, a plan for so-called Dreamers? Without that, you don't have any bargaining chips with the Democrats. So Democrats aren't going to get on board with this. It's going to be very tough. So it's kind of an opening salvo for Trump ahead of 2020 and then to go on from there.
Meantime, we are hearing that a fourth migrant child has died in U.S. custody. What can you tell us about him?
Yes, a two-year-old boy died after crossing the border and being detained by Border Patrol near El Paso, Texas. This actually happened in April. He had a fever, trouble breathing, and officials took him to a hospital where he was diagnosed with pneumonia. This is what's being reported so far. He was hospitalized for about a month before dying this Tuesday. And this is the fourth child known to have died in Border Patrol custody since December. And we know the pressure's on for the government to fund more medical support at the border, considering families arriving at the border, but this is, it's very slow going, and you have families in very small and crowded conditions at Border Patrol stations, and it's not going to ease up anytime soon.
The World's Monica Campbell on the Immigration Beat. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sonia Nazario is steeped in the conditions that cause people to flee their home countries for the U.S. She's walked along with them as they've made the trip north from Central America. Nazario is the author of the book Enrique's Journey, and she has a few different reactions to the White House immigration plan.
I don't think that we should necessarily not look at a more merit-based system like Canada or Australia have. This plan is looking to move from about 12% of people who come here legally merit-based to about 57%. I would say that that goes way overboard, but certainly, you know, our economy has changed. We don't need the muscle and brawn that we needed in industries 100 years ago. We need more brains. And so I don't think that it's necessarily a horrible idea to say maybe we should move more in that direction. But we also have to recognize that we're a country that values families. That's the core of who we are. And now we're asking immigrants who come here legally that it may take them 10 or 20 years. I mean, there's 4 million people waiting in the queue to be able to bring their adult children, for example, from the Philippines or from Mexico. You have to wait 10 or 20 years, and that would not even be possible under this proposal.
Your work has taken you into the trenches of our country's immigration troubles. You made the journey twice from Central America to the U.S. border with migrants. So unlike most lawmakers, you've experienced this on the ground. Is there a way the U.S. Congress can actually stop these caravans from coming? And what sort of agenda would make that happen?
I think instead of cutting all foreign aid to these countries, as President Trump just did, I advocate that we need actually a Marshall Plan of sorts to try to increase aid, and that it's much more cost effective to deal with these problems in these countries. And there are programs that we have piloted in the United States in these countries that do reduce violence and try to reduce corruption and build good governance and try to do the things that you need to do in these places so people don't vote with their feet.
Right. So a merit-based proposal doesn't address the root causes. What are the other two things you think need to be dealt with?
We're at a time with the greatest dislocation of people, 65 million refugees roaming this earth, and we are limiting it to 30,000 refugees that we'll take into this country a year. It's a ridiculous number compared to what other countries are doing. So I think we need to treat those people with compassion instead of locking them all up in these horrible for-profit prisons like we are now. And here's the third part of my proposal, which liberals don't like. I think that if you lose your asylum case, we should roll out ICE and go and get you and deport you, because we must be a country of laws. We cannot take in everyone from around the world. And we need to send a message that if you lose your case, you will be deported.
I mean, just given the framework of all immigration policy right now, I mean, you're suggesting three things under this administration. Is any of this possible?
I don't think that this is possible, because immigration is a wedge issue. It's not meant to be solved. It's meant to be used to rally the bases on both sides of the political divide. And I think that that's what we are largely seeing.
So is immigration reform just going to hang in limbo? I mean, this proposal from the White House seems dead on arrival.
Well, I think Americans who are tired of seeing people shouting at each other from opposite sides of the political divide can push for policies that work. I went to Honduras 3 years ago and saw U.S. funding at work, where I went to the worst neighborhood in the murder capital of the world for 4 years in a row, San Pedro Sula, Honduras. And in that neighborhood, we funded outreach centers where kids could go after school and get away from the gang, help getting jobs. We funded a program started in Los Angeles where kids, if they had the 9 risk factors of going into gangs, they got a year of family counseling, and it reduced dramatically their odds of engaging in crime. And most importantly, we went after the killers in these neighborhoods. In Honduras, 96% of all killers get away with it because no one feels they can step forward and say, this person, I witnessed this murder, because then they will be killed the next day by the gangs. And for so many of these migrants, yes, there are lack of jobs and there is corruption and there are all these problems in these countries. But often the triggering event is someone is threatening to murder you in the next 24 hours because you haven't paid the war tax or extortion, or because your son hasn't joined the gang. And those people, deterrence does not work. They're not thinking about what they're going to face at the U.S.-Mexico border. They are thinking about getting out of Dodge. And I saw this in January when the caravan left January 14th from San Pedro Sula. The police were arriving at the bus station, and I witnessed these women with babies in their arms leave the bus station walking on this darkened road north in pouring rain. That is people voting with their feet, and they will continue to vote with their feet no matter how nasty you make it for them here.
Sonia Nazario, the author of Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. The Republican governor of Alabama has signed a law that would ban almost all abortions in her state. Governor Kay Ivey said the law is a testament that, quote, every life is a sacred gift from God. People's deeply held beliefs on this question of when human life begins often have a religious foundation, and yet they end up with different answers. Here's the world's Matthew Bell.
Sister Agatha Munyanyi is a Catholic nun and a missionary from Zimbabwe. I met her at the annual Rally for Life in Washington, D.C. last year. She told me the issue of abortion is a controversial one in Africa, too.
In my country, in Zimbabwe, it's illegal to abort. You are actually sent to prison for doing that. It's illegal. It's a crime. You are not allowed.
And do you think this is a good idea?
It's good. It's good because, you know, we have no right to terminate life at any stage.
At any stage. For many devout Christians, life begins at conception, and abortion is wrong. Some, though, have struggled to find a place to stand on the political divide over abortion. Kirsten Powers is an author and co-host of the Faith Angle podcast. She's also Catholic.
I do believe that life begins at conception, and that is a religious view.
But Powers says she's come to think of the abortion issue in less than black and white terms.
I have a lot of friends who've had abortions, and, you know, I've supported them, and I don't judge them. And I think it's a difficult issue, and I think it requires a lot of humility. We're not, thank God, a theocracy. We are a secular country. We're a pluralistic country with a lot of people who believe a lot of different things, you know, and I don't think that you can, in an area where there really isn't anything near consensus on this issue, that you can impose those views on other people.
There isn't total consensus either in the Jewish tradition. There are different views on abortion. But the question of when life begins goes all the way back to the Talmud, the original source in Jewish religious law. It describes the first stage of human life as conception, when the soul comes into the world. But the fetus at this point is referred to as mere matter, not fully human yet. Orthodox Rabbi Lila Kajdan says that all changes when the baby is born.
There's an idea that the act of birth itself changes the status of the fetus from this non-person, this watery matter, to a person, to a nefesh, to a person with a soul.
Kajdan says some of these issues are still being debated by Jewish leaders and that Jewish law doesn't fit neatly into either the anti-abortion or pro-abortion rights camps. The same goes for Islam, says Celine Ibrahim. She's a Muslim chaplain at Tufts University. But the question of when life begins, from an Islamic perspective, is easier to answer.
Scholars have the opinion that life does begin at conception, but they're considering not just the protection of an unborn life.
Muslim scholars see childbearing as a blessing, but having kids is not an obligation. Contraception is permissible. There's some disagreement on abortion, with some scholars being more strictly opposed to it. But many Muslim leaders would say there are legitimate reasons to decide to terminate a pregnancy up until 120 days after conception. Of course, there's all sorts of complexity and contradictions in different religious traditions. Hindus believe that the fetus contains a reborn soul at a very early stage, and the scriptures prohibit abortion. But the procedure is still legal in India. Buddhists from different schools of thought also believe that life begins at conception, but there's disagreement in Buddhism about abortion. Some say it's murder. Others, including the Dalai Lama, emphasize that this is a very personal decision with unique circumstances. So what do scientists say about when human life begins? Josephine Johnston is a medical ethicist at the Hastings Center in Garrison, New York.
I don't see a lot of discussion in the literature and medical ethics about conferring personhood before birth. And I think that that's partly a resistance to the notion that you can even think of the fetus at any point as separate from the mother until he or she actually is born.
Johnston says for her, it's difficult to think about the life of the unborn in isolation because there's always another human life that's involved, and that person's perspective is extraordinarily relevant. She says when medical ethicists have wrestled with that question about the status of an embryo or a fetus, they don't see it as just property, and they don't see it as fully human, but somewhere in between. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Antarctica is melting. At this point, that will come as no surprise. It's melting especially fast in West Antarctica, and a new study shows roughly a quarter of the ice shelf is now unstable. That sounds like a lot. The World's Carolyn Beeler was just in Antarctica reporting on these glaciers. I mean, the headline is ominous, Carolyn. What's really new about this study?
So this study used satellite images taken from 1992 to 2017 to measure the elevation of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And what it found is that a quarter of it is now thinning. That's what they mean by unstable. So what's remarkable is how fast this is going.
Did this study tell us anything new about just how much ice this region is actually losing?
It found that Thwaites Glacier, where I went, and Pine Island Glacier, which is next door, are losing about 80 gigatons of ice a year.
Study, a gigaton?
Which, yeah.
I don't even know what that means, but it's a lot.
That's how they measure ice, in these really big ice losses and these really big numbers. And that's a fivefold increase from about 25 years previously. It also showed more specifically where in West Antarctica, the ice is thinning. And it shows that the ice melt, which starts from warm ocean water melting the underside of the floating portion of the glacier, is steadily marching its way inland. And that matters because the farther inland this melting progresses, the less stable the inland ice is, and the more likely and the faster it's going to flow outward and break off into giant icebergs into the sea. And that is what adds to sea level rise. And in this region, we're talking about something like a potential 11-foot contribution to sea level rise. So that's why what happens down in Antarctica matters to all of us, especially us standing here in Boston.
This study used satellite data. How do the findings jive with what you actually saw on the ground when you were there?
So when we reached the face of Thwaites Glacier, it looked different than the scientists were expecting. It looked like icebergs that had broken apart and frozen back together. And none of the scientists I was with were expecting that. So this really reinforces how fast things are changing down there and why scientists might be surprised by what they saw.
The World's Carolyn Beeler. You can see photos from her journey to West Antarctica at theworld.org/Antarctica. Carolyn, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
So even more urgency to the challenge of solving the climate crisis. One way we can do that, of course, is to create more sources of renewable energy. Here in the U.S., solar and land-based wind power are growing fast. Now Massachusetts is trying to jumpstart a generation of offshore wind power, and they're getting help from across the Atlantic. Here's the world's Jason Margolis from New Bedford, Massachusetts.
When Joseph Massey enrolled at Bristol Community College, about an hour's drive south of Boston, he chose a brand new field of study, offshore wind power.
It's the new future. It's where everything's going to be. The growth potential, especially in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a huge initiative for offshore wind and renewable energy as a whole, which is fantastic.
The Massachusetts legislature is considering bills that would commit the state to 100% renewable energy within 25 years. To achieve this, the state will need lots more solar panels and wind turbines, and people like Massey to manage, build, or operate offshore turbines.
So once it starts booming in the United States, that's going to be where you want to be. As far as an engineer, that's where you want to be.
The federal government estimates that the coastal waters off of New Bedford are among the windiest in the nation. But here's the bad news. Here in the U.S., we don't know much about building wind turbines, out in the ocean at least. And here's some good news. The Brits do, and they're offering their help. Offshore wind is booming in the U.K. It's approaching 10% of the electricity supply there. Harriet Cross, the British Consul General to New England, wants to share her country's expertise. Yes, that would mean making money for British companies, but Cross says there are bigger stakes here, too.
We want the world to be more green. We genuinely believe that the clean energy is the future. So you find that the UK is really showing global leadership on things like the Paris climate change deal and that sort of thing.
British wind energy companies recently struck a deal to help develop Bristol Community College's new wind power curriculum.
We've made mistakes in the last 20 years that we've been doing this, and we can share that expertise with places like New Bedford so that they can do it more quickly than we have because they can avoid some of the pitfalls.
Students in New Bedford will learn the technical ropes to work in offshore wind. New Bedford could use a dose of new industry. The area has struggled economically in recent years. Now, you may be thinking, New Bedford, how do I know that name? It's where Moby Dick is set. And while the city may not be wealthy, its fishing industry is doing well. It's the most valuable commercial fishing port in the United States. So out on the docks, they're a bit wary of what the British are selling.
So trust me, there's not one commercial fisherman on this dock or on any other that wants offshore wind.
Edward Washburn is the New Bedford port director. Washburn says for the past decade, they've been focused on making sure that offshore wind turbines don't impact their fishermen here.
They've been commercial fishing in these areas. In some cases, their family's been doing it for centuries. So any change to that is not welcomed. You know, each one of these wind farms impacts different fisheries to different extents.
But there are trade-offs in New Bedford. John Mitchell is the mayor.
We see the effects of climate change in full view here. We've noticed that our beaches have eroded, but we also know that warming seas have changed the composition of the fish landings here. And we also know that ocean acidification looms as a major threat to the fishing industry.
Wind farms that cut our reliance on polluting fossil fuels can help reduce those threats. They can also mean jobs. British Consul General Harriet Cross says about 8,000 people are working directly in offshore wind in the UK, helping revive many older British manufacturing towns.
New Bedford is very similar to places like Hull and Grimsby in the UK. They've got a lot in common, and it means that there's been unemployment in the past. It's places that are kind of not as vibrant as they used to be. But that is all changing now, and it's very
This spring, Massachusetts regulators greenlighted plans for the nation's largest offshore wind farm to be constructed by European companies. The fishermen in New Bedford can see the writing on the wall. Port Director Edward Washburn says while they may be wary of new hulking windmills in their waters, they also know that fishermen need to be part of the conversation.
To be a successful port, you need to be versatile. You need to go and get opportunities. So there's a lot of supporting businesses on this waterfront that can, you know, fuel offshore wind vessels, fuel operations and maintenance vessels for the offshore wind industry. So we think offshore wind can be an opportunity that aligns with and coexists with the commercial fishing industry.
Even with British help, there are still plenty of barriers to offshore wind development in the U.S. The expense, aesthetic concerns, and worries about the impact on marine life. But the potential is huge. Some energy experts estimate that there are enough winds blowing offshore to power the entire East Coast. For The World, Jason Margolis, New Bedford, Massachusetts.
And thanks to Sarah Mises-Tan with station WCAI on Cape Cod for help reporting the story. That's all the time we got for you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.